sign up today for the Film Comment Letter. It's a free weekly digital newsletter featuring original film criticism and writing by Film Comment's editors and brilliant contributors.
The letter delivers exclusive features, reviews, interviews, streaming picks, news, and more directly to subscribers' inboxes before they're published on filmcomment.com the following Monday.
Sign up today at filmcomment.com. Welcome to the Film Comment Podcast. I'm Devika Girish.
And I'm Clinton Crute. We're the editors of Film Comment.
In our May-June 2020 issue, the scholar Abu Bakar Sonogo wrote of Med Hondo, the late great Mauritanian French filmmaker, that for Hondo, decolonization and independence were not simply a matter of regime change from colonial to post-colonial, but rather a radical and avant-gardist project. The cinema had its part to play in the realization of this emancipatory vision by liberating itself from all varieties of dominance, including those of form and tradition.
Hondo's brilliant and idiosyncratic films are a testament to that emancipatory vision. From his debut feature Soleil O to the grand anti-colonial musical West Indies, from the collaborative immigrant documentary My Neighbors to the anti-police noir Black Light, Hondo's films are both formally ingenious and politically audacious.
This Friday, Anthology Film Archives kicks off a week-long retrospective of Hondo's works, including some brand new restorations. The series is organized by none other than Abu Bakar Sonogo, who joined us on today's episode to discuss Hondo's life and work.
We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Welcome, Abu Bakar.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Do you want to tell us a little bit, just our listeners, who you are, what you do?
Sure. My name is Abu Bakar Sonogo. I'm an associate professor in film studies at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. So I teach film studies. I am also involved in the world of film preservation. I've been in the past few years now as part of my work inside an organization that Med Hondo was an active member of. The organization is called the Pan-African Federation of Filmmakers. So it's something that was created in the 1970s to basically start institution building within African cinema. As you know, in our context, a more systematic mode of engaging with the cinema emerged really with the advent of independence. It doesn't mean that there was no cinematic activity before. In fact, we can trace some as early as 1897, 1898 or so, but just on a more systematic basis, because of course, with independence, the desire to represent oneself became strong. Except when that came and the people who were interested in making films found that they had no access to either the means of production or the means of distribution and circulation, etc. So it was a problem. All these were controlled from without. And so they said, well, we're going to create our own institutions. And one of the first ones was to first get together, band together, and really bring the different energies in synergy, so to speak, and to create now, lay the foundation for the institutional building of African cinema.
When was that organization founded?
It was founded in 1970, officially, in Tunis, in Carthage. But there were debates that were calling for it at least a decade before. But it really gelled first, in fact, in Algiers in 1969, where it was clear that it was going to be created, and then officially in Carthage in 1970, we started with the very first African Film Festival, another new institution that they created as well.
Is that FESPACHO or?
FEPASI. No, FESPACHO was created in 1969.
Okay.
So you have, they first created Carthage, JCC, Journée Cinématographique de Carthage in Tunisia. And then 3 years later, they created FESPACHO. JCC, as you know, is in the north, northern part of Africa in Tunisia. She wanted one also in the southern part, for lack of a better term. And so they created FESPACO in Ouagadougou in 1969, which is a whole story in and of itself.
So Hondo was a major part of this group.
Yeah, I mean, Meando, in fact, it was a major part of FEPASI, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, he came slightly later than the Semben, the Vieiras, and so on. But definitely one of the most formidable advocates of creating what we call an industry, because he often said, in Africa, we have films, but we have no film industry.
Maybe we could start off talking a little bit about how Medhondo became a filmmaker and his experiences both in Africa and in France, which, you know, both those experiences are central to his films. So I don't know if you could tell us, just offer us a bit of a sketch of how he got to filmmaking.
Absolutely. Well, so he was born in Morocco, actually. So grew up there, went to school, then went to training, sort of hospitality schooling, like a hotel schooling, so to speak. And then started traveling because it was the colonial days. So the place where things happened were obviously in the metropole. And so, he did a couple of trips back and forth and finally landed in Marseille somewhere around 1956. But Marseille, as you know, is the closest point to Africa in France.
He was in his early 20s
It
then,
was somewhere
then.
in Italy. Exactly. And so he got there, 21 roughly. And so he got there and started, first to try to find a job in that field of work. He even at some point was employed by a mafia boss, believe it or not, in Marseille.
I believe it. That's believable. Marseille has a
Yeah,
reputation.
that's right. That's right. So, anyway, in the process of doing this, he got interested in the theater. I think his point of entry into the cinema is really the theater. So, he would make a bit of money working, and then he would pay for his classes in the theater. And then slowly from again, so moving up the ladder in the restoration business, so to speak, he moved to France and started to work there as well. And therefore, sort of joined a major dramatic arts course that was led by the wife of Jacques Feder. Those of you who know Jacques Feder, a Belgian filmmaker, very famous, lived in France. So she was absolutely, apparently, a magnificent, fantastic teacher who was also a master of the kind of acting, the method acting, let's say. So she knew Lee Strasberg, she knew the Kazans, and so on and so forth. And so that's really the one who really welcomed him, because sometimes he couldn't afford to pay for his tuition. And so she said, and so you come and tell her. He said, she, at some point, she said, "You have no right to pay to come to this course. Just come, and come." While she was rejecting all the Parisian yuppies who were coming to her course with issues of kind cinema and positive and all that stuff. So she basically took to him and trained him. Now, of course, as you know, the theater has offered a lot of personnel to the cinema in terms of acting. And so some of his roles, therefore, involve being on film set, playing extras. So you will mention that one of his first roles were to sort of play a jazz musician in one of the films where he had only one line. One. But he happened to meet another major French actor called Michel Simon, with whom he had to rehearse his lines and so on and so forth. So it really got extremely great training in this context.
Was he making a living as an actor at this time?
He was starting to make a living as an actor, yes. Yes, but again, in small roles, and increasingly big. Now you have two. Now, when you say an actor, actor in the theater, actor in the cinema. So in the theater, he started obviously making, of course, more. He was playing like everybody, the usual. If you live in Europe, of course, it's most likely the Eurocentric canon, so the Molière, the Shakespeare, and so on and so forth. But at some point, he thought that he should also make act. He and his colleagues, sort of the black colleagues who were around at the time, that they should gather together, create their own group, and then adapt plays from black playwrights. And so that involved, plays by people like Césaire, René Depers, Amiri Baraka, in fact, among others. I think that's, in fact, it's while playing Amiri Baraka, for example, that Godard saw him once. So he went to see the film, he saw it, sorry, the play, he saw it, and asked him to come and act in a film called Masculine Feminine a couple of years later. Anyway, so the theater is really his point of entry. So first trying to make a living. And so the theater, so in this, now that acting job sort of gave a different, a number of paths, right? So within the theater itself, in the cinema, in radio, and in television, right? So all those places were employing for different voiceovers, reading.
There's, of course, the famous just fact about him that he voiced the roles of Eddie Murphy in French dubs of Eddie Murphy movies.
Precise,
Beverly
yeah.
Hills Cop and whatnot.
Absolutely. I mean, he likes it. I mean, he likes it. I mean, it's an interesting fact about him, for which I think which often clouded people's understanding of him, because in fact, if you go to France, few people know about his cinema, but they definitely know his voice. They grew up listening to him while thinking they were listening to Sidney Poitier, Morgan Freeman, Eddie
Oh, wow.
Murphy, Muhammad Ali. He dubbed all these people.
Wow.
He dubbed Ben Kingsley and Gandhi, for example. He dubbed lots of people,
Oh,
lots
I
of people.
didn't know that he dubbed for
Absolutely.
Gandhi.
If you get the French version, if you get the French version of Gandhi, you'll definitely hear Ben's voice. No doubt about that. And so, he earned a living basically primarily through voice acting, that we have to say. Again, with the French context, where the question of race and racism obviously is front and center for people of African descent, because of course they colonized us, and as they like to say, a colonizing country is by definition a racist country. That is France Fanon, of course. And so that was the case. So okay, one of the things that he likes to he who is safe is that in order to pronounce, if you're mostly most of the time when you're from the colony, the question of the letter R, the way we pronounce the letter R as sort of colonials or former colonials, is just not the same as the ha 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 of the French, And so he had to learn how to do this. And to do this, they would ask him to take a pencil. I don't know if you can imagine the violence, a pencil in his mouth to really pull the sides of the jaws to now.
Actually, I took a French language course, summer course, after I graduated high school in India.
Okay.
I was told the same thing. That was the same trick told by the
Really?
instructor, to put a
Put a pencil
pencil.
in your mouth?
Yeah, that's so fascinating.
I'm gonna have to try this.
I never, I
Well,
mean,
I don't know
I
if
could
you want
never
to go
do
see.
it. No, it's, yeah.
It's unnecessary self-mutilation, but
Yeah.
I mean, I
he
don't need a
had to
perfect
do this.
accent. I don't aspire to a career as a voice actor, so I think I'll
Sure.
be okay.
Sure.
Although if anybody's listening,
Sure.
reach
But that's
out.
what he had to go through. I found this absolutely violating of anything, his culture, his background, everything, his identity, everything else, and everything else, everybody else who's not in that framework. And so that is the vilification of the African accent, and so
Yeah.
forth. So.
Well, it's interesting that he lived these kind of two lives. I mean, if you think of the voice acting as like a source of his income, really.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Where he's putting on this mask.
A life of assimilation, and then in his filmmaking, a life of really rebelling against these demands of the film industry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the great examples for that was when we brought him to Bologna, the Il Cinema Retrobato, for this micro
retrospective. You said like a small retrospective.
Yes. That year, Bologna had invited the daughter of Vittorio De Sica. And so when these two people saw each other, Med and the daughter of Vittorio, it was like, I don't know, like brothers from another mother or something. I mean, he was really Med because he loved the cinema of De Sica. And he felt some parallel between De Sica and him. Because he felt that, you know, De Sica was sort of often playing mindless comedies in Italian cinema as an actor. But he put his heart, his soul, and his political understanding and vision in his cinema. And so he felt that this was in part what he was doing, if you will, while working.
Right.
Also, don't forget, for the Hollywood system, for which he had often very little patience, as you know so well. So, so that's sort of came out very trenchantly during that event. And of course, his love for Italian cinema. And in fact, the fact that he's a genuine cinephile. I mean, he's probably one of the only filmmakers I know who spent his life watching, because you're a dubber, you watch films. So spend his life watching film, living off of watching films, right? And so that was absolutely fantastic.
So how did he move from theater to cinema? What was the impetus there?
The impetus was he obviously, you know, acted a lot in the theater, acting, of course, comparing what it meant to go to, you know, to act for the cinema, and of course, the experience of cinema itself. And one of the things he mentioned was that, of course, the theater has an impermanence to it. You go, you play once, and that's it. Yet, of course, in the cinema, once it's canned, you know, if you can come back a million times, as it were. So this idea, of course, of the immortality impulse of the cinema, if I can call it so, right? The idea that it captures the present for the future.
It's an archive.
Exactly. It's definitely an archive. An archive, completely an archive of time. It's an embalming of time, as the great Bazin would say. And so, that really he found absolutely attractive in the cinema. He's almost like Sam Ben at some point, when he also was asking himself, what is the best way for me to reach, if obviously the people I was interested in, of course, who moved from the novel, he remained in the novel, of course, but moved to the cinema. In his case, the theater is really the question of impermanence versus permanence of the cinema, although film preservation issues demonstrate that cinema also has elements of impermanence, obviously, to it.
Yeah. Let's talk about the making of Solelo. He made that in 1967, or that's when the film was released. What was the story behind his first feature? How did that happen? And also, if you could sketch a little bit the context of France and French cinema at the time, because Solelo is a completely idiosyncratic film to me for the 60s. You know, we know the 60s for a very different kind of French cinema. You know, it's also obviously really an important time for the French New Wave. And then Solelo comes, and it's absolutely unlike anything else being made at the time, as far as I know. And it feels, even though it's the first feature, it feels like the work of a master, in the sense that it is a very cleverly made film. You know, it's technically very, very polished. But it also has so much rage. I mean, that we can talk about that last scene and that scream. So yeah, if you could tell us, you know, set the scene a little bit for the making of Solelo.
Okay, very good. It's important for people to understand that before he made Soleil, at some point he decided to make films, and so he made two shorts before. One of which I think will be played, the Ballade aux Sources, which is kind of a riff on the message there is a return to the native land, so to speak. And then another sort of short sort of adaptation of a play. Now, Soleil, he was not really released in 67, it was released in 1970. He himself is aware that people write any kinds of things about the question, the dates in the cinema of Marondo are really also sometimes a challenge. His birth date, birthday, etc. Anyway, so in this particular case, he wrote it, he shot it over a number of years. That's really what happened because, of course, he couldn't afford, he was not considered a professional in the sense of you need to have sort of a certain amount of money to, to deposit before you can have a card in the French system. And so on. He didn't have that. And he had also no producer, obviously. And so the way in which he was making the political economy of the film was essentially to earn income as an actor. And anytime he had saved enough, he would call his buddies, actors, and so on, to come and act, which meant that it was shot over several weekends, over a number of years, basically. So that's how it happened. So that said, he often said that, of course, the idea of making it came out of his own experience, obviously, of racism. If you remember the beginning of the film, that's after the whole three historical sequences, when the protagonist arrives, I think it really has a sort of autobiographical element
Well, he's
to it.
trying to get
And
a job in a hotel, right? He
that's right,
keeps
not to get
so.
a job. Exactly. But before he get even get when he did his sort of his own restaging of the Lumiere arrival at the station, so to speak. He comes out and he looks very optimistic about his prospect. He says, I'm here, I'm home. He thinks he's home. and very quickly, of course, disillusion sets in. Disillusion sets in precisely in the process of meeting all forms of discrimination. So it's the experience of racism that he felt that really was raging because he likes to say that when I go somewhere, I want to communicate to meet the people I'm surrounded with to really have some human interactions and mutually fulfilling exchanges, as it were. But French society was, at least for all intents and purposes, closed to him, by virtue of his coming out of formerly colonized country. Don't forget, colonialism at least had officially ended just a I mean, he was he, for him himself. Of course, he came to France even before colonialism ended formally in his country and across most of Africa, of course. And so the memory of colonialism was very pregnant, obviously, in French society. And as I said, in a context of a colonial metropole, of course, racism suffuses because.
Well, there's this repeated line about the invasion, right?
That's right, l'invasion, exactly.
Yeah, and the graffiti that you see over and over again. I wanted to ask you about kind of the process of making the film again, and in terms of the writing and versus the editing, because it's this collage of different essayistic threads and repeated scenes and sort of, I don't know, vignettes, I guess. And they come
Vignettes
and
is the
go and like,
word, is the word.
setups. And can you talk? So to me, the film is so, it seems really, it's so energetic that it almost seems like it was made in the edit, like all these decisions, but it's also so controlled, as Devika said, that and seems so precise in its anger and its articulation of that anger that I just wanted to ask you about like how the writing process, like what's the script like as far as you know, and how much of
we don't have a copy of the script. I'm okay. Sorry to tell you. It was one of the very first questions I asked. Where do I find a script? Something like that. How do I know? I don't know. So the films for which we begin to have script somewhere around West Indies and the film that
so were they improvising,
No. But he definitely, it was extremely precisely written. Extremely precisely written. But of course, Matt, when he works on the script writing period just takes very, very long because he's never happy with so he keeps on improving until even the day of the shoot and in the process of the shoot and in the process of editing, etc., etc. So that's important to keep in mind. Second, there's the question of how does one tell a story like this? And so for him, it was always refusing, if you will, to follow the classical structure, but asking himself what exactly would allow me to get what I'm trying to get across. That meant, of course, using all the means that, let's say, the arts of representation, broadly speaking, put at his disposal. That's really important to understand when you think of his film, because there's always basically anything that the language of cinema makes available, anything that the language of theater makes available, anything that the language of painting, in other words, all the art that exists can be mobilized to help him get his point across. And so you see that, you know, sort of he moved very quickly from the fictional to the non-fictional, from animation to live action.
Songs play a big role.
Songs, obviously, songs are so axiomatic. So, and he had a genius for choosing his songs in all of his films, obviously.
Yeah.
So that's important to keep in mind. There's also, he's interested in the dialectic, which really informs really the choices in many, 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 many of the films. In Solari in particular, very clear. So the vignettes are really meant precisely to show something, and it's obvious to have a sort of a collision montage. It's very if you read Eisenstein's text on montage, you can see exactly what he's trying to do, although he was not really, arguably, I was not reading it while he was shooting the film, so to speak. But you can see definitely that impulse there in the process of making a film like Soleil. For example, if you remember the scene where you have two characters from the Caribbean who are trying to compete in who is the most assimilated, who speaks French, the bear, look at my skin, and so forth. My skin, after all, I had a point over you, my skin is lighter than yours, if you remember. Yeah, so it's a sort of lit, that sort of thesis element of the dialectic, but he moved immediately to the antithesis in the next week, where the three are, I think, walking up the stairs and they push this white guy who's carrying some fruits. And he screams, he screamed at them, you hogs, the way they speak, they refer to the immigrant in a denigrating manner, etc. That as far as the empire is concerned, light or dark, you are and will always be a colonial subject, a racialized subject, etc., etc. So, yes.
You know, you've mentioned Eisenstein, even though we don't know if Matt Honda was actually reading Eisenstein, but who were his influences? What sort of cinema was influencing, or not beyond cinema, what artists influenced these films? Because again, I'm just constantly struck by how completely idiosyncratic they seem. You know, to me, I watch Solelo or West Indies, I can't place them in a tradition of French or African cinema at the time.
Yes, you can't. You can't, because Because I remember, you have to remember this quote. That I don't know if I had included it in the essay I write for you. I wrote for you, sorry. It's the idea. I'm just gonna read it because it just comes up here. He said, "I've always tried strive for a cinema of rupture because I consider that African civilization, Black people have their own history, their own destiny, and their own expression, and that the cinema they make cannot be the classic cinema made by everybody else, with a beginning, a middle, an end, and kisses and love and feelings, etc." Not that he was against the last part and latter part of the quote. He just felt that there were many things, the many more urgent things to do at that moment, that he could postpone exploring those issues of love and so on and so on. He said, "I always told my colleague to make sure not to imitate the other cinema. Right? That they could, of course, be inspired by it, by many of his qualities, but not mimic it. Because for him, one should never mimic. You have watch all films if you want, love Godard, love Wells, etc., but not really try to be a clone of the masters, although the people known as the master, or of any other kind of modern film and genre filmmaking, etc., that one must always bring his temperament to that." And this is actually very interesting because it's also part of a certain cultural theory of African culture. The idea of, let's say, imitation, sort of literal imitation, so to speak, of, as Senghor would say, physis mimesis, if you will, where you try to have a reproduction of that model which you have in front of you, is not really a dominant feature in many aspects of African culture. The idea of seeking originality, to try to invent new forms, is in fact one of the axiomatic dimensions of that. Certainly, it's been theorized as such by people like Alun Diop and so on and so forth. For them, they always ask African filmmakers, "Yes, of course, watch all the films you want, but you are not the same. First of all, you come from a culture that's been around for much longer than any of these put together. Don't forget that Africa has some, is the first child of humanity to begin with. Don't forget. So there's a long tradition of history, of culture, of modes of creature, of dealing with the relationship between reality and its representation in a multiple form. Go to Africa, any of these 54 or 55 countries, you will see.
Even in Lumiere Noir, the Blacklight, I feel like, which is supposed to be a noir film, but it takes it just constantly shifting. You can't really get a you can't really get a grip on like what it's trying to
Absolutely.
do based on any understanding of genre cinema or expectations that you come in with.
Exactly. So you so don't expect to find an imitation of genre in whatever he does. For example, in West Indies, of course, he's trying to have a conversation with a musical tradition,
Right, but
et
it's
cetera,
unlike any other music.
but his
Well,
is no.
it's almost like something. There's a theatrical, and honest, but I do see a tradition. There, it is kind of coming out of a theatrical tradition, right? This constantly shifting mise-en-scène, the music coming in, the eras being kind of collapsed into each other. So you can kind of see that.
You just mentioned Senghor, and to me, the reference that comes to mind is surrealism, a little bit like Senghor and Césaire surrealism. I think that's an aspect of Soleil O. But I'm even thinking of, correct me if I'm wrong, because I know the dates are not always clear with Ahmed's work. But the film after Soleil O was My Neighbors, even though the
It
Is that
was,
correct?
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I find that film really interesting. I know there's only a fragment of that film that we're able to see now, a 35-minute fragment of what I believe was a much longer documentary. It's a documentary. It feels like a follow-up to Soleil O in many ways, because it's about the same subjects, the lives of African immigrants in France, in Paris, particularly in relation to employment, housing, these structural conditions. And I was so struck because it's a documentary. He's interviewing these people, you know, sort of like the man on the street style interviews. But there's so much formal sort of a scrambling of the visual language. Even the opening sequence, you have this man speaking. But it's so interesting that it's dubbed over. So there's this severing of like the image and the sound, you know, the image freezes. And so there's a lot of sort of formal intervention in how the image and the sound comes together. And then at a certain moment, you have the song, My Neighbors, which I found just layered over these ethnographic images of, you know, immigrant ghettos in Paris. So maybe, I don't know, maybe I'd love to talk about that film, but also, yeah, I wonder if you think that his films do fit into a surrealist kind of mode, the African surrealist mode.
You could. You could. I mean, for Mes Voisins, which is a film you were just referring to. You have to know first of all that it was, in fact, you might be interested in knowing that that in fact it was a response to a film that was made in India.
Oh,
actually, yes. I think he went to the theater to see a film by Louis Malle called Kolkata.
Okay.
He was absolutely outraged. Absolutely outraged. I said, I have to respond. I have to do something. I have to do something. And so he made this film. He made it.
Oh, wow.
It's a literal sort of a cinema speaking to cinema.
Oh, that, you know, makes so much sense. You know? And that's amazing because it's kind of the message of the film is you don't have to go to faraway lands
that's
to see how
right.
the people
that's
you
right.
colonize live. Just look
that's
a stone's
right.
throw away from your house.
That's
okay.
that's the these are the lyrics, right?
Yeah.
In other words, you know, if you think, what did he say? You know, we send our parents to colonize them, et cetera, et cetera. Now they're here with us. So you don't need to go to Kolkata or Delhi. Like in the competition of miseries, you know, you can find that right here
if
you look around among your neighbors. So it starts with Mes Voisins, but it's a sort of a, let's say, a test film almost prior to the long one. Now, because the long one, Les Bico Nègre, Vos Voisins, so it moved from my neighbors to your neighbors. All right. And Bico Nègre being a sort of a combination of, let's say, just derogatory terms for the N-word for blacks and the equivalent of that for Arabs, basically. All right. That's really the combination here. Now the longer version had, it's one of the most interesting ones. It's equally interesting in it because, first of all, not all of Mes Voisins makes it into Les Bico Nègre Voisins. Some of the parts are cut off. That's one. But it's not only document. There are also vignettes and fictional sections in Les Bico Nègre Voisins, which was actually very interesting experimentally because it's a film that started, as you said, in 1970, roughly, but that ended in 1988.
Oh.
Yes. Right? So it went through multiple versions. Part of it has to do with this idea that he would try to make a film with the immigrant workers.
Collaborating with them.
Exactly. Really, a collaboration, literally. But collaboration in the sense of this sort of a third cinema tradition whereby you would screen the films with the people who participated in it. But unlike the end of Chronique d'Identité, where whatever people say, well, that's it, there's a conclusion, and one goes home, here, he would reshoot the film on the basis of the debates that he would have with the worker. It's very different. Very different. Very different. And so he did that over years. So you have a version that's three hours long, for example. And he only shot the concluding sequence in 1988, and he said he actually had to stop because he had no more money. You know? But it was going to be an infinite or unfinished, or what I call the provisional film, a film always in the process of being made, and which would have taken sort of also the form of the evolution of these positive characters, the
So,
problematic.
were there how many versions are available for people to see?
There's one version that's at least in the possession of the archive that hosts his, that's the Cinéarchive in Paris. These are the archives of the Communist Party because he remained a communist all his life. I don't know if
Which
you
is
remember.
so clear from the films too, because he
Yes.
has always has an economic analysis of colonialism, you know, of racial
Absolutely.
capitalism. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Systems analysis, as it were, and so and yeah. So he was a communist all his life, and this work. So you have that. So as I say, you have the 33-hour version as well. And so one of the challenges will be when we decide to restore this. What's going to happen? Because obviously, the rest of directors cut becomes a bit problematic, if you will,
Right,
right? Because the first cut was his cut, too.
I think you got to do like an all day, like multiple, all the versions back to back to
Exactly.
back.
So, was My Neighbors a short documentary made before Les Bicots Nègres,
Yes,
or
yes,
is it
yes.
okay? It was. And then some
Yes.
of that was incorporated into the larger kind of provisional
Exactly. Because
film,
Les
I
Bicots
see.
Nègres really begins. Oh my God, when you see it. It's too bad because it's one of his only films that was not subtitled. That's why it's not available for this
I
reason. The
see.
only,
Okay.
I mean, the second reason is, of course, that the print has circulated a lot since we sort of since it was it received electronic subtitles and it was shown, I think, in 2019. People have really, really been asking for it, and it's not really in great shape anymore. But the opening sequence, a 21-minute opening sequence, no less. And primarily with one person addressing the audience directly. And it's, to me, those of us who've done a bit of film theory, 70s film theory, and the analysis of, so the relationship between cinema and ideology, it does not get better. It doesn't get better, but it's spoken, it's embodied, it's enacted and moved. It's really a deconstruction, if you will, of the history of cinema in relation to the representation of Africans and people of African descent. Oh my God, it's
Oh
really.
man, you have
I hope we have a
to
chance
bring it
to.
to New York.
It will come, don't worry, it will come soon.
So, let's move on to West Indies, which is available in a now in a new restoration. So it's really exciting. But also to me, West Indies, I mean, all of his films are just completely unique. To me, you know, I put Soleilo on my list of my sight and sound ballot of the best films of all time, because it really
Fantastic.
is a film that to me is people, you know, when people say, oh, best film set in Paris, Soleilo for me is the number one,
That's
you know,
absolutely possible.
because I think the metropole can only be experienced in its true form by those that it colonized.
Absolutely,
But
absolutely,
West
absolutely.
Indies, I think, is the great kind of cinematic and technical achievement. You know, to
Yes.
me, it does seem in a way like the pinnacle of his filmmaking because of its ambition and because of the kind of spectacular way in which it condenses and presents the entire history
That's right.
of the slave trade, you know, of colonialism and the slave trade. It's something that you could show in schools, but it's at the same time, it's not simplified. And it was shot on a real slave ship. That's right.
I mean, not a real, I
No,
mean, a real
yeah,
sort
but
of built, yes.
a reconstruction of a slave ship, and the entire film is shot, almost the entire film is shot on that. So, can we talk a little bit about that? You know, what just when he made that, you know, what do you know about what inspired him to make it, and also what its reception was. I'm curious.
Well, he says at least that he always wanted to make a film that would pay homage to Haiti. So, and through Haiti, of course, the West, the Caribbean, West Indies, for the lack of a better term. And so he came across this play called Le Negrier. If you want, you could be translated that, but something like The Slave Driver, something like that, by a writer called Daniel Bookman, who had lived in Algeria. And Algeria, as you know, was really a hotbed of Pan-Africanism at the time. And so before Bookman, Fanon had been there, other people had been there. So there was sort of a whole contingent of people of African descent who had also sort of joined there. And so he wrote that play. So Methondo saw the play and loved it and decided to adapt it in the theater first. So that's stage one. For years and years and years, I even came across a poster of him trying to present it in Senegal, for example, in the 70s and so on and so forth. So it was first a play. Now, in the process of rehearsing and making the film, many—I mean, staging the play many times. It then dawned on him that, in fact, it could be turned also into a musical. So he's the one who imagined all of that stuff. So it's because of the Negri is just a classical, it's a play. But he said, well, what if we tried something else? First of all, by building it in a replica of a slave ship, that would be, of course, close to a in this case, a an abandoned factory, which would even immediately symbolically establish the relationship between the two. In other words, that the conditions of possibility of the Industrial Revolution are to be found in the transatlantic slave trade. And that, of course, many authors have written at length about it. If you think of Walter Rodney, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, or Capitalism and Slavery, and many other things. I mean, you see very literally why, how the very places in England, in France, in Belgium, and all those places where the Industrial Revolution begins are those that had, ports, slave ports, very little sort of one-to-one relationship between them. And so this the setting itself literally lays that symbolically. Factory, slave ship. Very literally. Second, of course, there's the question of okay, how the question of Methondo's problematic, which is never to show simply consequences, but also causes. Right? If you remember Boleslas Matuszewski's film, he used to say that one of the limitations, obviously, one of the difficulties for cinema is, of course, we were talking 1898 now, is of course that it often only comes when events have happened. Right.
It's a retroactive art.
Exactly. It's
Yeah.
ex post facto, as it were. Now, here, for him, the present is only meaningful insofar as we see it as the effect of past or no longer, not really past forces, or the hold of the past always has a certain hold of on the present. And one must, in fact, recover that hold for people to understand why we are where we are, why we are who we are. And so to do that, of course, the question of the centrality of the historical. History is so central to every aspect of Methodism, from Soleil, if you want to take Soleil as sort of the first feature, even from Ballade aux Sources, because he goes back into sort of the vestiges of sort of Roman occupation in Africa and so on and so forth. So history is really
even
yes.
Blacklight Lumiere Noir has archival footage from Vietnam. I mean, we can get to that, but a very strong historical impulse. Yeah,
exactly. So the question of history is really both the horizon, the methodology, the approach, and even the foundation of this cinema. So the question of history is because he believes, if you will, that without historical consciousness, we are just empty and floating brains, as it were. Historical consciousness is key. You see that in, of course, in Soleil already. The whole first three sequences are really about the question of history. You cannot understand the migrant today if you don't first go through this animation sequence, if you don't first go through the divide and conquer sequence, the christening, the missionary sequence, and so on and so forth. You need to do that before you can understand. It's the same with West Indies in a way, because of course, how do you understand the contemporary situation of people of African descent in the Caribbean if you don't understand, of course, that which got them there in the first place? So the transatlantic slave trade, the triangular trade, as they used to call it, and then the role it played in, of course, in relation to, of course, the colonizing power that was involved. And you see a sort of kind of long and huge trial of various colonial forces, etc., that were involved, including the Spaniards, the Dutch, the French, the Brits, everybody.
The Americans, too,
the
appear.
Americans, of course, of course, Louisiana, this wonderful, with this southern accent.
Yeah. So there are a couple things about West Indies I wanted to talk about. One, just the scale of the production is magnificent. So I know that it was at the time the biggest budgeted, the African film with the biggest budget. So what do you know about the how he got the funds and just the making of the film, and how was it received? Because it's scathing, it's unforgiving.
It is.
You know, it calls out everyone. It calls out obviously the colonizers, but also the it has the Africans who became part of the colonial bureaucracy, for their own interests, and then also those who fell for the illusions of the metropole. So it's just so unforgiving. So yeah, if we could talk about both the production aspect and the reception, I'd be very curious.
Well, in terms of production, you're right. It's really the one of the most the well-funded films that he ever had. I think probably the two most funded will be that and Saraunya in some way. The sources of funding, I mean, so we still need to sort of do a little more about that. But what he definitely, the idea for him was to try to make the most beautiful film possible that he could about that experience. And so he always said that about his film, that regardless of the political economy of production, the film has to look like $1 billion if possible, because that the people deserve quality. And that notion of the people deserve quality is really quality that is being demanding at the level of research, being demanding at the level of ideological clarity, being the immense, demanding at the level of the complexity of the analysis, and of course of all aspects of the cinematic language that are of course involved here. So he decided to. So one of the things he does, for example, with the sort of the setting that he had, and don't forget, again, he comes from the theater. So the notion of mise-en-scène is what he does. That as a professor, so he comes with a particular acumen there. And here, you see that there's even a kind. I mean, again, I'm sorry to always come back to Eisenhower, but it's really that's what it brings to mind. If you remember the battleship Potemkin. But you also have a kind of a class-based structure here, where of course the officers who are on top and lord over the sailors or the bottom, and the whole circulation between the two is really part of the overall
The
scenography,
architecture, yeah.
architecture of the absolutely. Now here it's even almost more complicated because of course you have three level, right? Not only two, but three. So you have of course the leadership, so the king, the emperor, the French kings, emperors, and so on, and the like African lackeys, so to speak, until the character, sort of the person playing the role of the mayor, for example, in a film. But you have the bourgeoisie, various form of the bourgeoisie, the middle class, et cetera, that are in the middle. And of course, at the bottom, you have the people who are, and really he orchestrated a really brilliant circulation between the three level that honestly to me remind me of sort of pushing and sort of a Battleship Potemkin really to the next level here. In particular what it does with the camera work, because people are, I mean, it's just a one location. So imagine the level of mise-en-scène of timing all these actors to come in and going out with a great precision so that the camera will pick them up. It's
It's really quite breathtaking. I
really
mean,
absolutely virtual, the demonstration of what mise-en-scène means. But they would probably be proud of this because but it will also be interesting because here what he does is also that question of what do you call the circulation of various moments of history at once. Right, it's not just one time, one space, but it's multiple times and multiple spaces at once. I mean, if you remember that scene, for example, which to me is really one of the most emblematic, you have that scene where you have, after this whole panoply of people who are trying to encourage people to emigrate to France, because of course they're emigrating for a number of reasons. One, of course, is to do the job that the French do not want, so to be at the lowest rung of France. On the one hand, the second is, of course, to avoid the desire for independence. Don't forget. So remember those prayers, no to independence, no to independence, by offering some semblance of affluence in the metropole. Well, the questioner and depopulate, literally, if you depopulate a space, of course, sort of the living condition might be felt to be slightly less complicated. So there is that. So moving people from one side to the other. So in the process of this migration, so you remember that the family, so there's the man, the wife, the children, so they were going up this ramp, basically toward Air France that would take them to France. And you have this beautiful song, Farewell My Land, Farewell My Country, Farewell the Sun, etc.,
Adieu,
etc.
soleil. Yeah, very
Adieu
beautiful.
soleil, adieu maison, and so on and so forth. And as they walk, you have within the same frame the encounter with the slaves who are coming literally within the same frame without any attempt to cut or to make it clear to the viewer that we are moving now. We are having a literal flashback in continuity within the same frame.
I sorry, this is a kind of a non sequitur in us in some ways, but while watching Lumiere Noir, Black Light, which is a contemporary film, for its time,
Correct, correct,
and
correct.
there is a scene where these, I guess, undocumented immigrants from Mali are being sort of the police are sort of lining them up, and they have their hands behind their heads, and then they're put into a hotel room. And because I was watching all these films back to back, it felt like a scene from West Indies. White cops leading these black men, putting them into rooms. And he does have this ability to evoke so much of history in a single image.
Yes. I refer to that, the condensation image. That's really one of the signature more dimensions of his cinema. Really collapsing so many sheets of times into one And therefore, really, precisely, I mean, it's subliminal. It's both clear and subliminal at once. It really jolts the mind of the spectator in a way that's absolutely amazing and unforgettable as a sort of a cinematic method.
Yeah. So how was West Indies received? I mean, I'm curious about the critical and commercial reception of these films. Where did they screen and what was the response?
West Indies was screened in France, because that's where he lives. It was also screened in the Caribbean, obviously. And there are at least two stories. There's one, I mean, the question of circulation of made films is really often very sad because there's always somebody who thinks they're smart and tries to get, to trick him in one form or another, and throw the money, and almost never, seldom makes it back, unfortunately, to the filmmaker. But he tells this. So there's a story of the film showing the film in Guadeloupe. Guadeloupe being still a French department, as you know so well, along with Martinique. So. There's sort of a branch of the national television stations in France. I think this one was France Trois, so sort of the third channel, so it's a national channel that's based in Guadeloupe. And for some reason, because of course of the pure and radical indictment of colonialism, the station did not want to interview him. Apparently, the people walked to the station literally with the machetes and said, "You are gonna interview Metrondo, or we are going to bring your station down."
Oh my God, it's just like in the
Yes. And sure enough, the interview happened, and it was a really well-received film. You saw Janet Maslin's response to it in definitely in Europe, etc. But in Africa, as you know, that was what remains one of our problems. There's no control over the means of distribution, and so it would have shown in places like Algeria, like Tunisia, for example, and reception again differs. For example, in the film, there is that scene of the African king who receives a sort of European general or something like that, and tell your king, Marie Antoinette, etc. So I'm giving you these presents from Marie Antoinette, etc., etc. Apparently, when the film was shown at the Carthage Film Festival, there was resistance on the part of many Arab countries, because they felt that it sort of was a critique in some ways of them, right? Because it is a sort of
Oh,
a you see he's a sort of Muslim figure, etc., etc.,
interesting.
sort of an indictment, if you will,
The
of Arab
Arab
slavery,
monarchy and
and
yeah.
all that also, right? So the rumor started to circulate apparently at the festival, and the Algerian Ministry of Culture, without his knowledge, put a bodyguard at his disposal. So the driver was also the bodyguard. Whoever driving him throughout the festival was also the bodyguard. And it's only when the gentleman reached the airport and I saw him took his luggage, et cetera, that he told you, said, "Oh my God, I've been sweating here for the past 10 days because I was really here to protect you. I feared for your life because there were calls of even a desire to assassinate you."
Wow.
Yeah. So his films are really very powerful, have been so have elicited different kinds of forms of censorship. I think I mentioned it in that essay
Yes.
of different kind. African governments, for example, for Biko Neg, they actually went to Wari Boumediene, who the Algerian president, and said, "Don't show this film at this festival."
I mean, what this really reinforces is the system analysis in his films because ultimately, you know, his analysis of racism is also a structural analysis. It's
Absolutely.
Not saying, just simply saying, you know, white people are bad, you know, people of color are good. And so many different people feel attacked because it's about the system. It's about slavery. It's about, you know, exploitation. And so many people are seeing themselves attacked.
Of course, because everybody's we're all complicit in one form or another. So it's hard to live with, no doubt about that. So I think I mentioned the idea of the bidirectional gaze in the cinema of men.
Yes.
He's as uncompromising with African leaders as he is with himself. He's extremely uncompromising. And I remember even with myself, I remember sometimes, you know, when we would go to some of these events, should we introduce him, or discuss and so forth. And then at some point he'd ask, he'd look at his sister and say, "Do you think he made Africa proud?"
Oh, man.
It's a tough, what do you call it?
Tough critic, huh?
Absolutely. Not a tough critic, but tough threshold to live up to.
Yeah. So I want to move on and maybe this we wrap up with this one. I've been mentioning Lumiere Noir throughout this conversation because it's so different from these other films in so many ways. So first of all, it's set in the contemporary moment of its making. It is a film actually that is, the protagonists are white, but it still is about colonization and immigration. It has this wonderful detour to Africa, but you know, for the first maybe 30, 40 minutes, you're thinking, why is this a Med Hondo film? You know, it has this wonderful kind of bait and switch. And it is really the film that is, of all these films, that is really committed to genre. It plays out like a thriller. It plays out like a murder mystery, a geopolitical thriller, and of course, a police procedural. So, I'd love to hear from you, you know, what you know about the making of this film, you know, what kind of inspired it, and what to you is distinguishing about this film.
Well, one of the first things to note is that it's an adaptation of a book written by a French author. The author's name is Didier Denix, who might well be considered, let's say, one of the allies, so to speak, within the French context, because, of course, even in the worst days of colonialism, they were often also figures within their own polity that found colonialism unacceptable. That happened throughout history. And so he was one of those who really, in his film, tried to put this question to his own state. And I think we have example of these early in the colonial period. We think of people like René Vautier, Chris Marker, Alain René. They're all sort of part of that kind of a bit of lineage, as it were. And so it was during a period where, again, as it does in the US, and every once in a while, the migrants are used as scapegoats to the inadequacies of domestic policies, etc. We're seeing it more than ever today. It might be worse in the next 4 years in North America here, both in Canada and in the US, for that matter. So it's terrible. So it's an adaptation. So he tries to be as faithful, if you will, to the original book as he could. And so it is indeed, again, it also is very much on a continuum with his other film. Because how you look at Med's films, I think they are a fantastic ethnography of France. Ethnography of empire in many ways. And so this time, that desire that's been present in Soleil, as it were, Now he's taking up, if you will, he looks at it now from within, that is by from a film, from an author who's looking at his own culture as it, as if you're the foreign one, so to speak. And so that's why, you have friends or sort of white friends, protagonists, etc. So as if to say, well, this is not just me looking at, if you listen to your own authors, you would see that the problem is indeed there. So almost taking us back to the problematic of Biko Negro, Voisin, and all that stuff. You look in your neighbor. Yes, go ahead.
And this idea that you take any contemporary problem, police
Yes.
brutality or violence against white French citizens, you take gang violence, you take corruption, and somewhere you'll be able to trace it back to the exploitation of colonized bodies. I think that is the revelation of the film.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's actually to push this idea even further. You could argue that the future of the colonizing world will soon be the past of Africa. In other words, that which colonialism rehearses on black bodies and brown bodies around the world very often comes back like a boomerang into the heart of the metropolis itself. We see it everywhere, everywhere today. And in particular, around the question of, the fascism, in other words, the sort of fascist undercurrent in colonial society, colonizing society. That demonized the demonization of the other carries within it an element of fascism that's inescapable. And that, of course, is something that Césaire himself wrote in his Discourse of Colonialism. Right? He remember he said, well, Hitler is the diamond of the West. In other words, the logical conclusion of the Western project. Hannah Arendt didn't say anything different. If you remember, she wrote that trilogy of totalitarianism, which, started with colonialism, fascism, and so on and so forth. And so the link between the two is, in fact, anti-Semitism, colonialism, and fascism. So the link between sort of between the three is either in a way, in inevitable in a way, they're within, so the demonization of the other almost necessarily leads to the camps. Almost necessarily leads to fascism. And that's really where I remember, I think you have this fantastic quote in Lumière Noire, which says, democracy stops where the interests of the state begin.
And that is not said as a critique, but as it's said by a minister as positively. I mean, it's said like
Absolutely.
democracy only lasts until this point. I thought that was just fantastic.
That's right. And that is, of course, an invitation to really interrogate democracies and prepare, even potentially interrogate the democratic system itself, because we like to say that it's the least bad of all the
Voltaire.
system. Exactly. Now, the question is, are we literally so limited that we only have to settle with the least bad of things? Can't we really do better than this? I think in some way there's also that interrogation that's at the heart of this. I think that Hondo deconstruct all the pretenses of democratic societies. The democratic society that is racist is by definition undemocratic.
One thing that I really loved about Lumière Noir that also appears in the other films is how funny it is. It's a very bleak film, but Hondo really has this eye for visual gags.
Yes.
So there's a scene when I was watching the film last night that I just caught my eye where he walks into this, I don't know what kind of shop it is, some kind of mechanic shop where he's looking for the brother of the wife,
It's a poster shop for movie posters, right?
Is that what it is?
Because it's called like Cine Express or something like that.
Right, that is what it's called. And there's this incredible scene where the detective is walking in and there's a poster of Spike Lee movies and, you know, these Hollywood movies. And then there's some kind of smutty French poster of a naked white woman. And there's a black man who's cleaning the poster while shielding his eyes, you know? And there's a lot of, there's this amazing scene in West Indies where you have all of these posters, not posters, sorry, advertisements when the African family appears in Paris and it's like a railway station. All these incredible like visual gags and that, there's this just a strong element of satire and parody even within this serious critique. Just wondering if you could speak to that, this role of humor.
Yeah. Well, the role of humor, I think, in part has to be traced with back in part, I would say, to the oral tradition, if you will, within the African context, which he always claimed. In other words, that it is not necessary to only be bleak in the context of showing, let's say, the most difficult condition. History is not certainly the history of Africa has not been in the past 500 years, let's put it that way, kind. Let's say history has not been too kind to Africa, let's put it that way, yeah, in the way in which it has been interpolated through different. So it's a very, very, very painful history when you think about that. But the ability to transcend is also in part what, in some ways, humanizes us precisely. So one of the ways in which precisely one could think about the possibility of resistance. Now, humor becomes one of the modalities of resistance. In other words, expressing the possibility to transcend one's condition. But also, if you remember, for me, there's always a reclaiming of the tradition of struggle. Always, with West Indies, if you remember, it really takes us back to that, that in order to really, it's not just an expose of, you know, the dreadfulness of the system, etc., but it also, how does one do something about it? And in that regard, if you look at the conclusion of Soleil, even that you see some form of joyful, but not quite, in other words, so humor is always, if you will, always taken up to a certain point. So it first of all distances the spectator and of course the subject from, let's say, the gravity of what has been presented. But it also makes it possible to show that, in other words, you know, sort of entertainment, for lack of a better term, must or can be used also for emancipation. In other words, it's irreducible to modalities of escapism, as it were. But it is also a weapon. Humor is also a weapon for liberation, if one knows how to calibrate the different, calibrate it in relation to the rest of the presentation and deconstruction and analysis of the various discourses that he put forward in the film. That's really, really important too. So yes, he has a feel for humor, for some comedic moment. Again, right from Soleil, if you remember, the guy, the Chaplin-esque character at the beginning of the film. The scene in the, you know, in the bar, etc. Yes, they definitely exist in a multiple set of ways, but it's dark humor, part of that tradition. I mean, it reminds me of Achebe, for example, who used to say that proverbs are the palm wine with which words are eaten. All right.
It helps it go down.
Yes, precisely.
Easy in a sense.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precise.
A spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down.
Thank you very much. Thank
But
you.
the Achebe line is better.
Right, I think so, a little bit more. Yeah, there's also just like, there's just little touches and silly, like the goth assistant, Guyo is goth assistant who has like spiky hair and eye makeup. I think that these touches are really funny too. They're just, he just has like a sense for the absurd that pops up here and there.
He I would venture to say that if things were not what they are, in other words, because he's aware of the history of the representation of Black subjects in the cinema, and that they have been primarily interpolated in the comedic line. Look at most films in Hollywood about Black people, for example. So he's extremely wary about that. It's extremely wary about that. If that was not a dominant regime of representation, I would argue that he would have been a fantastic director of comedy. Fantastic director of comedy.
Yeah, I think so. That seems clear. So I think we wanted to wrap things up just and ask a little bit more about the retrospective. Can you just give us some details on what's happening, what you're going to be, when you're going to be attending?
What should people not miss?
Yeah, what are the films that are just, you can't miss this, you're never going to have another chance to see it?
I know that's a tough one.
That's a tough one.
The rarities then, maybe which ones are the most, the...
Okay, let me bring this thing to mind.
The least frequently screened.
Exactly, okay. Okay, so in terms of screening, so you have Soleil, which I think many people would have seen. I think the rarities, Ballade aux Sources and Mes Voisins, I think these have not been sufficiently seen. So it's important to see Ballade aux Sources. It's really Matt Hondo's very first effort at filmmaking. Yeah, no, really gorgeously shot. It's shot. It went with a colleague of his, Bernard Nanté. Apparently the soundtrack was stolen in the process of the making of the film. That's why it's silence. But according to research, because one of our colleagues who works at who used to work at Cine, the Communist Party archive, her name is Annabelle Aventurin. She's of African descent, and so she really, really felt very closely to the film that made, and decided to try to find out a little more about it. So she met the colleague that Med went to Africa with, and it was revealed that in fact there's a beautiful soundtrack that they had to accompany this film. And if you listen to the soundtrack, it's really out of this world. The soundtrack is called Kadia Blues, Kadia Blues, by somebody called Kante Fasili. Kante Fasili was one of the giant African guitarists in the 1940s and 50s. Who was sort of, with Keita Fodeba and so on and so forth. People like Keita Fodeba were really major figures. Fanon cites him at length in his discussion on national culture and so on and so forth. So really giant. So, and a poem was also written to really, in fact, it's very important because it's really a film in which Med is almost in an identity quest. The poem definitely reflects that, because of course he's of both, Black and Arab descent, so to speak. And so this is like almost a Du Boisian double consciousness quest. So who am I? What side of me should we be foregrounded? So it's just a very beautiful quote that should in fact accompany this. So the version that you're going to see is incomplete because it lacks the music that was, of course, the actual soundtrack, then the music that was supposed to accompany, and the poem that was to accompany, right?
Well, that sounds like unfortunate that it was screened, the silent version will be the one that's screening.
That's right.
Nonetheless, I think that does sound like something it must, to be missed.
You must absolutely see that. Mes Voisins, obviously, which was... he himself had almost forgotten about Mes Voisins. The film premiered at the Berlinale Forum, I think, in 1971. And they had kept it. And so it was found, I think, re-found back in, I mean, let's say 2017 or so, somewhere there. And so has not circulated that much. So because the audience will not be able to see Les Biconnes, which is the more complete and which really has so many unforgettable moments. I'm just wetting people's mouth here for when we restore it, which hopefully will be very, very soon in the next 2 or 3 years, hopefully. Okay, I think these are some of those. Watani must also be seen because Watani was very interesting as an experiment. He did this in two versions, the English language version and the French version, and they are not the same. The footage is the same, the images are the same, but the soundtrack, very different.
That's from 97, is that right?
Or 97, yes. So 99, if my memory is correct. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Okay, well, we'll definitely make sure to link to the retrospective in the description. So any listeners who want to find out when these films are screening, please check that out. And maybe you'll catch our guest today in person.
Hopefully, I should be there on Tuesday and Wednesday. So whenever those dates are. So Tuesday the 26th and Wednesday the 27th, I think.
Excellent.
Well, I look forward to seeing you there. And
likewise.
Thank you so much for making time for this. I really appreciate this. And this was such an illuminating conversation. I'm excited for Hondo Week next week.
Yes, so, yes. Exactly. I'm very happy Matt Hondo is coming to New York. It's been a long time coming. We were supposed to be there when he was alive. It would have been infinitely more exciting. I think there was something in the plan in 2018, 2019, etc. But unfortunately,
well, we have his cinema.
Exactly. Exactly.
The Film Comment podcast features original music by Greg Einge. Film Comment is a publication of Film at Lincoln Center. Since 1962, Film Comment has been the home of independent film journalism, publishing in-depth interviews, critical analysis, and feature coverage of mainstream, arthouse, and avant-garde filmmaking from around the world. Visit us online at filmcomment.com.